this evening we probably will only cover one verse, because I think this is possibly one of the most critical elements of the church, because every apostasy that has afflicted the church, from the Catholic Church to the Christian Church to the institutional churches, it's all really based in here. And so I think the more we understand about this concept of shepherding the flock among you, the better capable we're going to be of seeing why the churches of Christ are so different from most other churches that are in existence. And we'll kind of develop why that is. But a lot of it has to do with the term shepherd. Because unfortunately, in the religious world today, this term doesn't really have a significant usage or a significant meaning. I think most of us are aware that the Latin word pastor is used in Ephesians chapter 4, but the preachers have kind of taken that term and they apply it to themselves. And so the real concept of a shepherd as it is revealed in the scriptures is almost non-existent in the religious world today. And that's why I wanted to spend quite a bit of time, not as much as we did last week. We'll cover the first couple of pages pretty quickly, but I did find a couple of more verses in here that I wanted to talk about. But let's just go ahead and start at the top of page one with that first sentence, which is, a shepherd is one of the oldest occupations in the scriptures. Starting with Abel, then Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Rachel, Moses, Moses in Midian, and David, they were all shepherds. The shepherds are used throughout the scriptures. The first time that it's used is by Jacob when he's speaking about the future, and he describes it. And then, as you see in the upper portion of the first page, Moses pleads with God to give the children of Israel a leader so that they won't be sheep without a shepherd. So that's really the first time in the scriptures that concept of a sheep without shepherd is set forth. Then again in Isaiah, we talked about this a lot last week, so I don't want to review too much, but Moses was considered the shepherd and Israel was considered the flock. Then I think one of the most important verses, and the one I want to develop a little bit more this week, is found right in the middle of page one. It says, have I ever spoken a word to any of the judges of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people? So the shepherds that God had appointed, and he'll list a few of them a little bit later when we get to that verse, but the shepherds would have been the judges that we read about, including Samson, including Jephthah, including Barak, and all of these different judges God called my shepherds. So have I ever spoken a word to any of the judges of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people? So what do we read about those judges? Well, we read that God is punishing the nation. When the people cry out to God and repent, then God sends them this judge, or now we learn, this shepherd, to lead them back to the safety of the fold that they had left. So keep that in the back of your mind. We'll come back to that a little bit later. Then, of course, David was a shepherd, and David used Psalms 23, which is quoted by a lot of people today, as a understanding of God as our shepherd, and that's in the middle of page 2, where the Lord is my shepherd, and the Lord is their strength, and he will shepherd them. And so the shepherd was a very important part of Israel's understanding of how God was dealing with them. He leads me by still waters. He brings me pasture. So the concept is that a shepherd would lead, he would guide, he would protect, he would care for, and do everything in his power to keep them from being harmed, to keep them from being uncomfortable. Now, probably the most important verses regarding the shepherds are found here on the bottom of page 2, where actually at the very bottom, after it talks about the Messiah being the shepherd, I will judge between sheep and sheep, and I will establish one shepherd over them. So Jesus is now the shepherd, and unfortunately, in the New Testament, there just isn't anything really revealed or described. So we almost have to go back to the Old Testament to really understand what God expected shepherds to do and what he expected his son to do. And so as we move now to page 3, I think that we can start developing this a little bit more. And we focus on Jeremiah 3, Jeremiah 23, and Ezekiel chapter 34. So in Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 15, I will give you shepherds according to my heart who will feed you with knowledge and understanding. Now, this is a direct reference to the elders of the church and to their function as a shepherd over his people. Not preachers, but men qualified with the qualifications in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus chapter 1, men who are elders, who are overseers, and who will shepherd. And so even though the term is only used twice in the New Testament, once in Acts chapter 20, and then again in 1 Peter chapter 5, and then also just in passing, and when he speaks of the gifts that Jesus gave to the church, he speaks of shepherds. But as I say, if you talk to people about this in the denominational world, you're just going to draw a blank stare because they do not understand this concept. They do not understand the ideas that are set forth here. Let's look at Jeremiah 23, and then I'll open it up for comments or questions. In Jeremiah 23 and verse 1, it says, "Woe to the shepherds who destroy and scatter the sheep my pasture." So this would be describing those men who use the office of a shepherd, similar to what we see the scribes, the Pharisees, and the Sadducees doing in the first century with Jesus. They're supposed to be the shepherds. They're supposed to be the ones who are caring for the sheep. But as Jesus says in John chapter 10, all that have come before me are just hirelings, and they don't really care for the sheep. So in verse 3 of Jeremiah chapter 23, it says, "I will gather the remnant of my flock out of all countries where I have driven them and bring them back to their folds." Now, the folds that he's talking about are the New Testament churches, the local churches. Those are the folds. It's not a single fold he's going to bring them back to, but it's their folds. And so once we get to this idea of autonomy, we're going to see that God had this in his mind. Remember, he said, "I'm going to give them shepherds according to my heart." And what he's going to do is he's going to give them shepherds over small local churches, men who are deeply caring and concerned about those people that they have been appointed to work with. And so he says, "I'm going to gather the remnant of my flock, and then I'm going to bring them back to their folds, and they shall be fruitful and increase. I will set shepherds over them who will feed them, and they shall fear no more, nor be dismayed, nor shall any be lacking." So there's three good explanations of what the Lord meant when he said, "I'm going to find you shepherds according to my own heart." First of all, they are going to be feeding the sheep. They're going to be taking care of any of the things that might cause them to fear. And they're going to take care of anything that they might be lacking. So it is in the term shepherd, I think, that we get the greatest understanding of what the work of the eldership is and what the role of the eldership is. And so that's why we're going to spend so much time on this, because elder is just a title. The term elder simply means an older man. It doesn't really infer or describe anything about the work. And overseer is a Greek term that is not found in the Old Testament at all, so it's not real clear either. But this one's really clear, and yet, as I said, most denominations don't even use this term. They don't even understand the term. They don't understand these prophecies. And so when we in the church are talking about these things, like I say, you almost get a blank stare. All right. This concept of shepherds and how the Old Testament promised, God promised that he would put shepherds in the church and that they would take care of the sheep. Okay, well, on the bottom of page 3, we have how not to be a shepherd. We have God just so angry. These are, you know, in Ezekiel, these are the people who have been destroyed. I mean, they've come out of Jerusalem. There's only like 4,000 of them left because the shepherds didn't take care of them at all. And now here we are in Babylon, and they're not doing any better. And so he starts out in verse 2, "Woe to the shepherds of Israel who feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks?" Now, that goes without saying. I mean, the whole function and purpose of a shepherd is to take care of sheep, not to eat the sheep, not to steal from the sheep. Look at verse 3. "You eat the fat, you clothe yourselves with the wool, you slaughter the fatlings, but you don't feed the flock. The weak you have not strengthened, nor have you healed those who were sick, nor bound up the broken, nor brought back what was driven away, nor sought what was lost, but with force and cruelty you have ruled over them." Now, let's jump back up to verse 15 of Jeremiah. "I will give you shepherds according to my heart, who will feed you with knowledge and understanding." Well, this is what he wants to get away from. He doesn't want shepherds like Jesus was dealing with in the first century. Shepherds who used the sheep, disdained the sheep, looked down on the sheep, didn't care about the sheep, and so... "Woe to the shepherds who feed themselves and not the flock," is his first point. And then maybe the most important is verse 4, "The weak you have not strengthened." Well, that's a role of the shepherd in the New Testament. He is supposed to strengthen the weak. "You have not healed those who were sick." So when people are dealing with spiritual problems, the elders need to be there to work with them. "Nor bound up the broken, nor brought back what was driven away, nor sought what was lost." So... the shepherds that God wants, the shepherds, when Peter says shepherd the flock, we have to go back to the Old Testament to pick all this up, because, as I say, it's not really described in the New Testament. Jesus is described as a shepherd, but it doesn't really give us a lot of information. If we didn't have Psalms 23, if we didn't have all of these passages in the Old Testament broadening and widening our understanding of what they were supposed to be doing, then these terms wouldn't mean very much. And unfortunately, I think that's why many other churches don't have this knowledge of the Old Testament scriptures, and therefore they don't even see it as something to look into. Most churches have bishops. They have people who oversee, but very few churches consider them to be shepherds or to look upon them as individuals who are supposed to shepherd the sheep. So... in verse 11 of Ezekiel 34, he says, "Indeed, I myself will search for my sheep and seek them." As a shepherd seeks out his flock on the day he is among his scattered sheep. Well, we all know the church is the body of Christ, and that most of the things God says he's going to do, he does through his people. So when those individuals, whether they're elders or not, when we see what God's expectations are, what he wants to see in the church, where people are seeking for the lost and seeking for those who have been driven away and the broken and the hurt and the sinners. Paul got onto Corinth because they were letting that sinner just sin with impunity. They didn't say anything. They weren't seeking him. They weren't seeking to bind up what was broken or bring back what was driven away. So when God says he wants his flock shepherded, this is the specific idea he has. This is where Peter said the Old Testament prophets were ministering to us. Well, this is one of the ways they ministered to us. They gave us a description of a shepherd that you just don't find in the New Testament. And if you want to understand the role of the elders, the work of the elders, the work of the shepherd, then if you start in Genesis and go all the way through the Old Testament, you're going to get a clear composite of exactly what God wants these people to do. And it's their responsibility to make sure that it gets done, because in Hebrews 13:17, on the middle of page 4, they're going to give an account. They watch for your souls as those who will give an account. So this is something that is really, really important. All right, that's about all we're going to do talk about as far as the shepherds. Now we want to talk about the limits of their authority and the limits of the work that God has given them to do. Anybody have any other comments or thoughts on this concept of a shepherd? Because it's such a vital part of understanding what God's expectations were for leadership in the church.
Dad, I have one question. That in the same Ezekiel which you showed, that my sheep are scattered from the mountain to mountain, and you have not taken care of that, and they wanted to find a green pasture, so you have not led them, but they have scattered from all the mountains. So what is the meaning of their scattering from the mountain to mountain in the same Ezekiel which you have taken the quotation just now?
Well, the mountain to mountain would describe isolation, and these are people who have been driven off, and you got a sheep on top of this mountain, and a sheep on top of this mountain, and a sheep on top of this mountain, and there's no shepherds. The sheep are just scattered on top of the mountains. If there were shepherds in India, and you went out to talk with them, and you saw a sheep up here, and a sheep on another hill, and another hill, and no shepherd to be found, you would understand that they were derelict in their duties. They were not doing what they were supposed to be doing. Does that help?
That can help. But can we make one application on this? Like that means in Isaiah 2 and verses 2 and 3 is talking that all the people will go, all the world will go flow to the mountain of God. That is the house of, where the temple of God is. So the church, that means as represented by God in the Old Testament as a mountain. So here that means we can take an application like that means the people are they wanted to find a green pasture, they're mountain to mountain, that means church to church finding, but no truth is found. So mountain to mountain, but that is not God's mountain where the people has to flow. That is the Lord's church. So people not coming, we didn't search them, but we can gather them on the God's mountain that you may have the green pasture. Can we make such types of application on this?
I think that Isaiah is a very symbolic passage. The mountains in Isaiah are all, well, I guess I'd say, you remember in Daniel where we have that statue and you have these different empires coming and going and the Lord's, and then the stone is cut out and it rolls down and breaks the images and pieces and then becomes a great mountain. So the authority of God and his kingdom and his Christ is a never-ending authority. And so the mountain is describing supremacy and power and majesty. Here, I think it's just literal. I think that he's just literally saying that my sheep are just scattered everywhere. They're on top of the mountains and nobody's trying to find them. It's on a dark and a cloudy day and my sheep are in these terrible situations scattered throughout the whole world as a result of the dereliction of the shepherds in the first century, or excuse me, in the days of Jeremiah and Ezekiel. But now God sends a shepherd, and now he's going to seek out the sheep. And I think that's dealing with what happens in the book of Acts, Prince. I think that Paul and the rest of the apostles and prophets are sent out into all the world searching for these sheep that are on tops of mountains and hidden here and there and not even knowing where to go. And so once they're brought into the church, which is what God is going to be doing, then he's going to set up shepherds over them because they're not going to be scattered anymore. So it's hard sometimes to know whether it's symbolic or whether it's literal, and you just have to really carefully sift through the section here. But I think the concept, I mean, it's not literal. There's no people that are scattered upon the mountains. But the point is, if you see a sheep all by itself up on top of a mountain and there's no shepherd around to take care of them, that sheep's in bad shape. And I think that's God's point. That's the point God's making.
Thank you, Dad. Understood.
Oh, sure. Yep. Anybody else? Okay, then, on the bottom of page 4, we have our first chart, and it's so important that we understand the basic nature of what we call church autonomy. And the word autonomy just means self-ruling. Auto is like automobile, is self-propelled, and auto just means self, and then nomos means rule or law. So each church is self-ruled or is self-governed, and here God is going to explain exactly how it's done. So he starts in verse 1 by saying, "The elders among you I exhort," and then he says, "Shepherd the flock of God which is among you." Now, the word "among you," as you see on the middle of page 4, is a word that has what we would call a spatial usage. In other words, where are you right now? Are you in a house? Are you in a car? Are you in the open? Are you outside? These are spatial things. And so the concept here is that this is the flock that you are in the midst of. This is the flock that is in you. Matter of fact, literally, this would be shepherd the in your midst flock, because it works kind of like an adjective, in you flock, among you flock. So the authority, work, and influence as elders is limited to that specific church that appointed them. And if they go on vacation or if they visit another church, they're there as a Christian. Now, they might say, "I'm an elder of the church where I came from," but they could not say, "I'm an elder here, that I'm going to continue my work as an elder while I'm on vacation in whatever church I'm in." That's not what this verse is authorizing them to do. When they visit another church, when they go on vacation, or if they step down as an elder in one congregation, then that is the limit, excuse me, their authority. So each eldership is to tend the flock in which they are in the midst of. And as you see at the bottom of the chart, it says the charge allotted to you. In other words, the Lord has given them a specific limitation. This is what he meant when he said, "I'm going to bring you to your folds, and I'm going to give you shepherds after my own heart." And so the shepherds here, I think one of the critical things, when you look in the denominations and a lot of churches, the function of the elders and the function of the bishops is administrative. Their main job is to oversee and make sure that all the churches are working, but the individuals get lost in the shuffle. They get lost in the cracks. They drop through the cracks because if you have a bishop over many churches, or if you have an elder over many churches, well, he's not going to have time to get into the individual situations of the people. He's not going to have time to get to know them and to develop a relationship with them and to guide them and to direct them and lead them. I think that's one of the most important elements of the fact that God wants elders to be working in a single congregation, is because that's the only way that they're going to be able to take care of the sheep. If they're not living among them, I mean, it'd be like me being the shepherd over a bunch of sheep and I never go out. I got five flocks, and every once in a while I go check on them, but for the most part I'm on the phone or doing this or that. Well, that's not a shepherd. That's not the kind of shepherd that God wants over the churches. So turning to page 5, we get a concept. I put at the top of the page the verse. I just wanted to read through it. "Shepherd the flock which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion but willingly, and nor for dishonest gain, not being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock." Singular, flock, not the flocks, but the flock. And this is the nature of the difference between local churches and the one true church, which we talk about when we read Ephesians 4:4, one body, and the church is the body, and we all understand that that's a universal church. But look at all these verses on the top of page 5 that talk about the local church. Appoint elders in every church. Appoint elders in every city. All the churches of Christ salute you. In 1 Corinthians 4, it says, "As I teach everywhere in every church." 1 Corinthians 7, "So I direct in all the churches." And 1 Corinthians 11, "We have no other practice, nor have the churches of God." And then in 1 Corinthians 14, as in all the churches of the saints, the women are to keep silent in the churches. So you see that the church is broken up into individual local congregations of elders and deacons and saints, and their needs are cared for, they are taken care of, and the elders are limited. You see that chart on page 5 where I put lines between all the churches, because the elders in one church are to tend the flock of God which is among them, and the next church over is to tend the flock of God which is among them, and so it goes. And the New Testament is very clear about this. There's nowhere in the scriptures that authorizes a organization above the local churches and in between Jesus. And so that's just really important for us to understand. I make a point toward the middle bottom, page 5, and that is that the elders are being protected here. The elders are being protected. Their responsibility, they're going to give an account. Well, if they're going to be giving an account for 5 different churches that they never get to, but they have to account for every member, that's not going to work out very well. But then on the other hand, there's an interesting point, and that is that the human beings look at this command as foolishness. And that's why they struggle with it. That's why they've always got their hands on it. That's why the Catholic Church works the way it works. That's why the various denominations have a hierarchy. They have someone at the top who's directing everything, because that's how they see it. That's exactly what they see. And so this is one of the most foolish commands in the scriptures, because you don't see anybody doing it. It's clearly a command. But as Paul points out in the bottom of page 5, God chooses foolish things. And having individual congregations serving the Lord with no ties to any other congregation, just a vertical relationship between them and Christ. There's no horizontal relationships in the churches when it comes to authority and when it comes to how they are to work together. So, as I point out on the top of page 6, those in this world see organization of individual groups into a larger group as the first step toward power and influence. Money, power, status, and influence are all increased if you have a larger presence. So 500 local churches with 50 to 100 people would seem to many worldly-minded people as a foolish weakening of their power. And what we need to do is organize them. We need to get them into a collective where they can work as a unit. But God didn't choose that. The chart on the top of page 6 shows what God chose. Jesus Christ is the chief shepherd. He rules over and he takes care of the responsibilities of the collective church. He's the one who's in charge of any evangelistic efforts that are bigger than a local church can handle. He will handle it. We can count on him to handle it. We don't have to struggle and look for a way to create a new organization or a new structure that to get this job done. We need to trust in the Lord with all of our heart. But what happens, as you look at the chart on the bottom, is that human beings are constantly looking for a way to get involved in this organizational structure. I think it's a lack of faith myself. I think that you're much better off to have Jesus as the chief shepherd, being the only one who is working in the universal church or working with more than one church. He's the one that can bring opportunities to them. He's the one that can seize all the needs all over the world and can direct his churches to do them through providence and through whatever means he wants to do. And we can trust that. We don't need a human institution. But that's what always happens. It happened in the 1850s with the Christian Missionary Society. They weren't getting out into the world fast enough, so Campbell and some of those other people, Alexander Campbell, some of those other people, said, we've got to have an organization to mobilize the churches. Well, they already had one. They had the Lord. So what they had to do is move him out of the way in order to put their institution in there, and that's exactly what happened. And so, same thing in the 1950s. The church wanted to get involved in activities that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, these radio programs that they wanted to do, and these orphan homes that they wanted to get involved in. And no single local church could do that. So they started looking for a way to activate more than one congregation. And this time, they came up with a sponsoring church arrangement where one eldership is over the work of many congregations. Well, again, that's not in the scriptures. It says, tend the flock of God which is among you. So God's wisdom and love for the sheep is shown in this command. The work of shepherds is to work with sheep. It's not an administrative thing. It's not a power trip. It's not a money thing. It's each eldership is working with those individual Christians and seeking to help them. And once we understand that, then this passage starts to take on a very important meaning. And I think most of us do understand that. We are just absolutely not interested in trying to activate more than one church. We are more than content to work in our local congregation, just like the Lord planned, and to accomplish what needs to be accomplished. But most of the denominations and most of the churches that exist today, they don't have shepherds, they don't understand shepherds, they put preachers in and call them shepherds, but they don't do the work of shepherds, and they're not qualified. All right, anybody have a comment or thought that they'd like to bring out on this?
Hey, Alan, I have a quick thought here. So, you know, whenever I talk to people about what you've just alluded to, and that is the pattern that God set forth in the New Testament compared to what we see in the world today, you know, one of the things that we always do when we study the scriptures, of course, is establish authority, right, by direct command, approved example, necessary inference. And so, you know, when we, for instance, look in Revelation chapter 2, and we see Jesus addressing certain churches, he's always speaking to a specific church. When we see, for instance, in Acts chapter 20, and Paul called for the elders at Ephesus, and once again, as you've talked about, you know, talked to them, about their responsibility of, you know, ruling over those. You know, take heed to yourselves and to all the flock, right? Acts 20:28. And how we see the wisdom of God in this structure, as you also kind of alluded to, where, you know, each of the congregations that have elders, those men will know each member of the church. They will be able to watch out for, you know, those that might rise up and speak perverse things, like Paul warned those at Ephesus. And so we see the wisdom of God with that structure, because the church also is called the pillar and ground of the truth and so forth. And so every example we see, every command we see, it's always to the local church. We never see anything addressed to any other entity above the church, because Jesus is the head of the church. And so there's just so many ways to dispel or to refute this worldly structure, that unless somebody just is dishonest or they do not want to look at the truth, it's just apparent that it's a local church with local elders watching over for the flock. The gospel sounds forth from that church, and that church will be held responsible, as we see in Revelation chapter 2, for the collective work that they do. So anyhow, just a few thoughts about that.
No, that's a good point, Brian. And, you know, we just can't emphasize enough. When a doctor quits working with patients to become an administrator, then he's no longer hands-on. He's no longer seeing patients. He's working with finances. He's working with coordinating to get more money or to get more of this or that, and he's not dealing with patients anymore. And that's what happens in every hierarchy. That's what you see with the Pope. The Pope is much more involved in the overall administrative functioning of the church. He's not on day-by-day working with people. And this is what happens with archbishops, what happens with cardinals, this is what happens with even bishops in many of the churches. Again, they're not called shepherds because they don't shepherd. They administer. They use their power. All right. Anybody else have a comment?
Well, I just have a question. This is Ken.
Okay.
Ken. Yeah, just... it made it sound as though none of these large, grandiose works are really necessary if all the local churches just do what they should. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. The Lord gave us, you know, as we have opportunity, He's given us the works that we can do. And like I said, if He wanted the church to be set up like Israel, He could have done that. If He wanted the church to be set up as many of these denominations are, working toward worldly power and worldly prestige, large buildings and a large presence, He could have done that, but He wasn't interested in that. Like Paul said, He chose the foolish things of this world and the base things, because His goal was to get the few who are going to find the truth into heaven. And so the major purpose, it's just like the people who say today, well, the church is only involved in evangelism. Well, that's the main purpose of the church, and it's not the church's fault that a few people are interested, but that doesn't justify us changing the work, because we're the only ones that can do that. The Christians are the only ones that are going to be involved in evangelism. So same thing with elders, Ken. Their primary function as shepherds is to take care of the needs of the local members. And I've made this point for years. If you don't have qualified elders, that work still has to be done. And that's why we have business meetings, and that's why we have men in the congregation who are going to be doing the things that elders are supposed to be doing, not as an elder, but the work has to be done. If there's a sheep that needs to be gathered, then someone's going to have to go out and get them. Someone's going to have to take care of these needs. And so everybody steps up. And that's why this congregation has such a wonderful, nurturing environment, because that's what people are trying to do here. Anybody else, or Ken, did that cover what you wanted to?
Oh, yeah, that was fine. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, on page 6, I went ahead and developed something that I think is really, really important, and we're going to move into it more in chapter 7, but that is that Jesus is the chief shepherd, and you can't have a human institution or a human substitution without moving Him out of the way. If He's the chief shepherd and He's working with each individual congregation, and the congregation set up something over, then that means that you've lessened His power. And I think the perfect illustration of that on page 7 is what happened in Israel. God made it clear, top of page 7, first chart, God was the king of Israel, and the judges were God's shepherds. And so each individual shepherd came along and worked with maybe one tribe, maybe with a couple of tribes. He was never over the whole nation of Israel, but he was functioning in the capacity that God had commanded. And that's why I said earlier, 1 Chronicles 17 is very important. Have I ever spoken a word to any of the judges of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people? So the shepherds were already in place. But when Israel comes to God and says, we want a king, this is the middle of page 7, make us a king to judge us like all the nations. Well, it displeased Samuel. Why did it displease Samuel? Because in verse 7, the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. So there's a very critical point here. And that's the same thing when people substitute a new manner of leading the people, whether it be a pope or a cardinal or a president, or I think the Mormons have apostles that are over the whole church. But when you do that, you have to reject Jesus from being the chief shepherd. Just like these people, they didn't think of this. They didn't think of the consequences of asking for a king, meaning that they were insulting God and deposing God from His position. But look at verse 8. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Well, that's exactly what God is telling Samuel is what God would be telling Jesus if a church were to come along and say, look, we don't want Christ to be head over all things to the church. We want some governing board, or we want a pope, or we want something else. And so as we read the passage, we see the terrible nature. They thought they were just making a more expedient way to rule over Egypt, or over Israel. But God says, no, what you've done is you're forsaking me just like you have since the very beginning. And so Samuel is sent to tell him, if you get this king, here's what's going to happen. And then at the bottom of page 7, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but we will have a king. So if you look at that bottom chart on page 7, where you have God as the king of Israel, now in the first chart above it, you see that God has the large position of being the king. Now, and this actually is what happened with the people, God recedes into the background, and their king becomes the central focus. So when a bad king comes along, the people go with the bad. If a good king comes along, the people go with the good. With Jeroboam, there never was a good king, and they never quit serving him. They never really sat down and looked at the scriptures and said, we're not supposed to be able to do this. And God could see that. And that's why he was so angry about this, because he knew what it was going to lead to. And then on the top of page 8, we have that Samuel said to the people, the Lord raised up Moses and Aaron. And then really important is verse 9, where it says, when they forgot the Lord their God, he sold them into the hands of Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, into the hands of the Philistines, into the hands of the king of Moab. So he's just summarizing all the work of the prophets. Then verse 10, they cried out to the Lord, not to their king, but to the Lord, and said, we have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and served the Baals. Then verse 11, the Lord sent Zerubbabel, Bedan, Jephthah, Samuel, and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies. So for that period of the judges, God was the king, and their shepherds were the judges whom God raised up when they needed one. But now, he says in verse 12, this is in chapter 12, now starting in verse 17, to show how angry God is, it says, he will send thunder and rain that you may perceive and see that your wickedness is great when you ask for a king. And so I think the same thing is true with the church. I think when a church says we need something bigger, then they're doing the same thing to the Lord that these people did to Samuel. They're doing the same thing to Jesus. They're saying, we can't have any confidence in you. We can't trust you to help us in evangelism. We can't help you to trust you to help us in benevolence. We need a physical institution that we can look to. But unfortunately, once you start that physical institution, you end up with creeds, you end up with people following people instead of people following the Lord. Instead of relying on the Lord, they start relying on other people. That's what happened with the missionary society, that's what happened with the sponsoring churches. And what was the result of it? Well, the result of it was people went off into apostasy, just like these people did. And so in verse 19, we have added to all our sins the evil of asking a king for ourselves. And Samuel says, you have done this wickedness, yet don't turn aside from following the Lord. Well, clearly, that's not what happened. What happened was these people became enamored with their king, and they were ultimately destroyed. Anybody have any thoughts on that? This is something I've been thinking quite a bit about, and I think it's a really good illustration. I think it's very clear that what these people were doing was deposing God to establish a king that would rule over the whole country. And now, today, we see the same thing. We have people who want to depose the Lord from being the chief shepherd. So, anybody have any thoughts on that at all?
Alan?
Yeah?
About the far back as my memory goes, this is Virgil. Through the period of time in the early 50s and middle 50s, there was a lot of references back to the later 1800s and early 1900s and departure at that time, and applying the same principles of departure to what was taking place when we started supporting orphanages, building hospitals, and having television was just coming in, and the Herald of Truth was one. And Batzel Barrett Baxter was, I think, the man that was more or less driving that thing. But the individual churches were not able to support it, so they gathered themselves together and started making one. I think, I want to say the Highlands Church in Abilene, Texas became one. But a man has always tried to take, and it seems, second guess God and not be satisfied with God's plan. God's plan, if when it's set up and operating the way that it should, we don't see a whole lot of confusion in the brotherhood, because each congregation, as you aptly pointed out, is autonomous in nature. And a departure from the scriptures can take place in one congregation and not affect another congregation. But when they're so joined together and dependent upon each other, it seems like when one falls, there's a half a dozen others that tumble right along with it. These things are lessons of the past and lessons of the current and lessons for the future that we need to pay attention to and make sure that we're applying the truth in all areas of this. God does not expect, like Holly Street, to be the church in the population. We're just one congregation, and by doing what we can do as an individual congregation, that's all that the Lord expects of us.
And that's exactly right. And we shouldn't want any more than that. That's what the Lord, that's how the Lord set it up.
Yeah.
And yet, what do we find? You know, there's always some young guy or some older guy who wants the glory, and he's come up with a great plan. It happens over and over and over. That's what they're dealing with in Malawi right now. Good point, Virgil.
We were going through this. I was thinking about that situation there that was taking place. That's too bad, you know. But what has happened in the past is going to happen in the future. We know that.
Yeah.
It may be a different colored horse, but it's still going to be a horse.
Well, and that's why I wanted to deal with this. I was hoping Billy Att was going to be on tonight, but I guess something must have happened to him. But I really wanted Prince to hear this, because we are still smarting, still struggling with the terrible outcome, the consequences of that split in the in the 50s. And we've watched these people get further and further away from the truth because, as I say, once you let Jesus go and you've got this human institution to rely on, that's when all things break loose, and that's exactly what happened to Israel, and that's why I'm using it here.
Yes. And another thing that we all have to be very careful of, the division that has taken place made two separate entities in a sense. I'm trying to explain this so that maybe I can fully understand it and get it out so that we all can. And that was between the institutional churches and the non-institutional churches. Now, the institutional churches, for the most part, have moved away into what we would call ultra-liberal activities and things like that. And then we have an element of non-institutional churches that is actually doing a lot of the same things that the institutional churches are doing, but there's some restraint that they have so that they can still sit and consider themselves non-institutional. And that's dangerous. That's like dealing with a half-truth. It's a difficult one.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, and I think that's exactly what happened to the Jews. You see that as you're reading through. After Jeroboam came in, those people were much more concerned with the creeds that Jeroboam set up than they were of even looking at the New Testament scriptures, and I'm sorry, the Old Testament scriptures.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened. God makes this point in 2 Kings 17. Judah did not keep the commandments of their Lord, but walked in the statutes of Israel.
Yeah.
And so the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel. Why? Because in verse 21, Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord, made them commit a great sin, and then Israel was impacted by that. We see that over and over and over again, and that's exactly what happens. These guys come up with these great plans, and then some of the weaker people in the churches start saying, well, this looks like a good idea to me, and other churches of Christ are doing it. Well, they don't make the delineation. Well, it's not in the scriptures.
Yeah.
It is a good idea, but it's not in the scriptures.
If you're running a business, it's one thing.
Yes. Yeah. Like I said, God chose the foolish things because he wanted to see whether we would trust him or not. And we see what happens if you don't trust him.
Well, all divisions, in my experience, of all parting from the scriptures, it started out in a very mild manner, and it's grown and grown. And it starts out with some sense of respectability, but once you take the cover off of it, you see the ugliness of the separation from the scriptures. Failure to follow the pattern, that's as simple as that.
Right. That's right. And the same thing is true when they change the work to social activities. All of a sudden, the church isn't involved in evangelism anymore. They're too busy with social activities to get around to that stuff.
Yeah.
That's not how the Lord wanted it to be. He wanted that to be our first priority, not our last priority.
Well, and Alan, the other thing that I think what you're saying is to help Prince is the Catholic Church came and functioned as the Lord's Church now. Look at their issues with their treasury, church discipline. You don't hear of Catholics withdrawing from people. And there's the single treasury, everybody, you know, it just, they've distorted every aspect of the Lord's Church to fit their thinking. And so Prince, as he's helping set up these churches, needs to be conscientious of the treasury, the discipline. It has to be kept separate, autonomous from each other.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And that's what happens once the church moves into a different hierarchy, then the scriptures are no longer as important to them as the creeds that are set forth by the people in power. It's what happened with Jeroboam. It's what happened that led to the Catholic Church. And it's what happened to all these reformers. I mean, these reformers who were going to reform the Catholic Church, they ended up doing exactly the same thing the Catholic Church was doing. They've all got their own hierarchy, and they've all got their own creeds. And nobody's studying the scriptures. They're too busy with their creeds. And if the scriptures violate their creeds, then they say, we're going to stay with the creeds. Going to stay with what our founder, what our initial person set up. And it's just maddening. It's so frustrating because, you know, as a result of that, people read what the Bible says about baptism, but they don't care. They don't even see it as an issue. And people read about what the Bible says about worship, but it doesn't agree with what they are doing. And so the scriptures have just gotten layer upon layer upon layer of this fat, this human fat of human tradition. And it's just their hearts are just so caught up in that that since they're not reasoning with the scriptures, you can't use the scriptures to reason with them. You'd have to use their creed books, but you can't use their creed books because they don't teach. It's just a conundrum. It's just a real, you know, round robin thing situation that we're dealing with.
Really
anybody else on any
of
this?
I just liked your comment about the human fat that got it. It's just, that was a great one.
Well, you know, that's what the scriptures teach, that their heart is wax fat, and they won't hear, they won't see, you can't penetrate, and that's what the Jews had done with the Pharisees' traditions, now is being done with human tradition, and it's created the same exact environment. And one by one, these churches, or these people who condemn the Catholic Church, turn right around and made up a church that almost does exactly what the Catholic Church does. They clean up all the abuses, but then over the years, the abuses creep back in because it's the same hierarchy. And like I say, it's just maddening. I mean, the Lord must just be so disgusted because...
Alan?
Yes.
Oh, I just wanted to make a quick comment. We think about this concept of delegation, and that's really what this is it's delegating, you know, certain bits of power to different people. What we find is not only do we have problems with, you know, now we have people who have too much power, but the individual becomes less effective. And the reason why is we're taking away the responsibility of individual members. There are really three offices that God has given us. There's just really the regular Christian who's supposed to be going out into the world studying his Bible. And then you have deacons who are essentially helping the elders and helping look over the congregation. And then you have elders who have been assigned specifically as these shepherds. But as you add more layers to this, the individual Christian really does become less effective because they think, oh, this really isn't my job. This is the elder's job, and this is, you know, the cardinal's job, and this is the Archbishop of Canterbury's job. When in reality, we still, as Christians, have a very important responsibility to look over ourselves and to constantly be involved in the process of the church.
That's an excellent point, Tim. That really is a good point. It just, again, the same exact issue. God knew what he was doing when he set up local churches. And when people come along today and want to reject that, they set up a plethora, just a total, complete group of new situations like you're describing, where we don't have to be responsible anymore because we've set up this institution to do evangelism for us, or we've set up this institution so all we have to do is give our money to the church and we've fulfilled our responsibility. Well, that was never the Lord's plan. It was to be individual. All right, anybody else on any of this? Because we're running out of time, so...
Hey, Alan, just one other quick thought for me, and that is, you know, I appreciate you bringing out these examples from the Old Testament because, as Solomon said, right, there is nothing new under the sun. Man's always tried to insert himself into God's plan, and one of the things that Prince and I have talked about in regards to the Church of Christ, kind of like Virgil alluded to the apostasies in the 50s and, you know, many churches being convinced to support institutions like the Herald of Truth. You know, I've talked to him about the Truth Foundation, you know, which we saw come up in, what, the late 90s, early 2000s. And here are brethren from the Church of Christ who would make many arguments that that foundation is no different than you and I going out and teaching somebody individually. And if you think about what an institution like that does to the eldership of a local congregation, it's really no different, right? They're adding a layer there that doesn't belong. And it's all in the name of preaching the truth. And, oh, it's just a gospel meeting and things like that. And so, you know, my warning to him, and I appreciate you guys bringing that up for him and certainly our preachers in Malawi, is to watch out for that, because even within the Lord's church, brethren will come up with all kinds of reasons to insert something like the Truth Foundation into the mix. And in many respects, it's no different than these other organizations that we're talking about.
Yeah, and that was the exact point that I was making. I think this is one of the most foolish things God has put into the church. It's this autonomy, because it's one of the things that has created the most, it's created the most damage, and it is something that just ever repeating, because people are looking at it and they're saying, this doesn't make sense to me. Well, for you and I, we say, well, it doesn't make sense, but it's the Lord's plan, and we're going to do it, and therefore it makes sense. But this has been the real nemesis of the church. It's this one command about church autonomy, and as a result of that, we've just seen apostasy after apostasy, denomination after denomination, and no way, there's no pathway back once you set this stuff up, except to get out of it, and that's just not going to happen. Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Virgil and Rob. Anybody else?
Yes, Alan. Listening to the conversation this evening, I don't know how Prince would feel about or anybody that's learning something about the church. You know, I'm always someone that likes to go back into time, and it may be elementary to a lot of people, but you're in a film trip. We have a lot to do with understanding a lot about the church's eldership, things like this. It may not seem like, you know, the right thing to do, but someone is learning about the church, you can learn a lot from those short little film strips.
Yeah, that third film strip on the apostasy and the restoration is just classic. I mean, it's just right down the line. And you're right, it is so good. The only problem is it's so dated now with the what people are wearing and things like that, that many people have stopped using it because it's just something that, but the material is great. I wish they would have upgraded it to make it just as pertinent now as it was then, but they never did. Thanks, Charles. Anybody else? Okay, well, it's amazing how quick that hour went by. Appreciate your comments and we got through the main thing I wanted to cover. So let's all give this some thought. If you had a chance to read through this material, I think it'd be very helpful because we've got to become versed in this. Those who refuse to learn the lessons of history, you know, like the guy said, are doomed to go into the same thing, because that which has been is that which will be. So